some doctors want to put a hold on fracking.
I think we have to really rethink carefully about whether this is the right thing to do.
I'm Carol Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, medical professionals wrestle with new data on how natural gas development impacts health for some Pennsylvania communities. And environmental groups look to their roots to address some of President-elect Trump's policy proposals.
This is power we know how to build. This is how movements have fought back against threats over many years.
Plus, one farmer sees a big difference between factory and pasture-raised turkeys.
We couldn't even sell him because people wouldn't believe he'd fit in the oven.
Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. For years, public health experts have worried that Marcellus shale gas development could be making people who live nearby sick. Questions have only intensified as scientists compile more data. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports some doctors want to put a pause on fracking while they scrutinize its impacts on health.
A few years ago, Walter Tsu began to worry about the impact of drilling on the health of people near gas wells. The Philadelphia doctor was alarmed by the idea of fracking waste potentially contaminating groundwater. Tsu wrote a resolution for the Pennsylvania Medical Society, which represents around a quarter of the state's doctors, calling for a moratorium on new hydraulic fracturing. It didn't go over well.
People said, you know, they built a new wing to my hospital now, and I really can't say anything bad about gas drilling, and it's too early for us to say anything because it's just started in our communities.
The Medical Society declined his resolution, but this fall, the group reversed course, calling for a moratorium on fracking, making it the Society's official position. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf opposes a moratorium, as does the oil and gas industry. The industry warns a moratorium would harm the state's economy and points out that increasing natural gas use leads to less air pollution from coal. Fracking can contribute to ambient air pollution, and for years, people near well pads have complained about health impacts. Tsu is a member of the group Physicians for Social Responsibility. The group has received funding from the Heinz Endowments, which also funds the Allegheny Front. Tsu says the best thing for the state would be to put a pause on new drilling.
I think we have to really rethink carefully about whether this is the right thing to do.
The Medical Society is also calling on the state to fund a registry on shale-related health complaints, as well as more research. Improving public health surveillance on this issue is crucial, says Ralph Schmelz, a retired endocrinologist from Pittsburgh and past president of the Pennsylvania Medical Society. At a recent conference on fracking and public health, Schmelz said when the drilling boom first came to the state, there just wasn't that much research on how it could impact health.
In the last, you know, 7 or 8 years, there's been an explosion of research in the area.
Recent NIH-funded studies showed increased hospitalization rates and incidents of asthma and premature birth near fracking sites. But Schmelz has a word of caution about those studies.
But we still have tremendous difficulty because those symptoms are very common symptoms. Asthma is very common. Exacerbations of asthma are common. You know, headaches are common. Migraine headaches are common.
Basically, just because there's a correlation between fracking and health symptoms, that doesn't mean fracking is the cause. He says more and greater studies are needed to help iron out this question. That's where a health registry would help. The idea for a registry was first floated 5 years ago by former Governor Tom Corbett's administration, but the state legislature chose not to fund it. The legislature changed course slightly last year, giving $100,000 to the Department of Health for a stripped-down version of a registry.
We're open for business to hear of any concerns or complaints.
Rachel Levine is Physician General of Pennsylvania. She says in the last 2 years, the Department of Health has received over 100 complaints from Pennsylvanians who said fracking nearby was making them sick. That includes reports of rashes, nosebleeds, and anxiety. Levine says while the registry is picking up more shale-related health complaints, it's just not enough to put a pause on the fracking industry the way the Pennsylvania Medical Society wants it to do. How much data would the state need to call for a moratorium?
I guess if there were consistent studies with compelling data that showed a clear and present danger, then we would certainly bring that to the administration's attention and consider that.
Meanwhile, the Medical Society's call for a moratorium will stay on the books, and Walter Tsu says he hopes the state government will take notice. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Thanksgiving might be over, but we're not done thinking about or appreciating food.
My eyes were popping out of my head. I'm not kidding. I was tasting something that tasted a lot like sweet tarts.
Later on the Allegheny Front, from holiday turkey to flavors that are a little more exotic, a smorgasbord of stories looks at the environmental aspects of food. Stay tuned as we dig in. Near the top of President-elect Trump's priorities for his first 100 days in office is undoing some of the signature environmental policies of the Obama administration. But recently, he softened his stance on climate change action, saying he'll keep an open mind when it comes to the Paris Climate Agreement. Still, his plans have been met with alarm by environmentalists, and we've been talking to people inside the movement about what the election results mean for their future plans. Most recently, I spoke with Mae Bouvie, executive director at 350.org, from her office in New York. The 350 in the climate group's name refers to 350 parts per million, the upper limit of carbon in the atmosphere that scientists say will still sustain life on Earth as we know it. The number is currently 400 parts per million. One of the goals of 350.org is to keep coal, natural gas, fossil fuels in the ground. And President-elect Trump has specifically talked about opening up more public lands to fossil fuel development, reviving the coal industry. So I'm wondering how your organization is responding to the outcome of the presidential election.
Well, we're very clear that his policies are a disaster for the climate, and he's planning a radical attack on our communities and the environment, which would include polluting our air, poisoning our water, destroying the climate. So we have no illusions about how serious of a threat this is, and we are going to fight back like the world depends on it, because we believe it does.
Climate change barely made it into the headlines around the presidential election or even into the last round of the presidential debates. How are you looking to engage some of those disaffected voters or disappointed voters, or even people who didn't vote at all around climate change?
Climate denial has gotten some new life because of his election and because Trump has nominated Myron Eagle, who is famous for only one thing, which is for being a climate change denier. By nominating him to the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, I think it's put a lot of people who weren't even necessarily thinking about climate change very much in a new sense of urgency. One of the challenges that we face politically is a sense of despair and a sense of just giving in and being cynical about politics. And we actually think that what he intends to do about climate change will jolt people out of that, because it will have an impact that will be experienced over decades and generations to come. Speaking to people about the impacts of climate change that have already been experienced and what is likely to change if the Trump agenda goes through will actually bring more people into the movement.
Do you think 350.org has been effective? And what are you looking to do to be more successful, especially in this new political climate?
We're trying not to take anything for granted right now, because while there was a lot of momentum on climate in the past few years, there was also a tremendous amount of terrible news coming out of the scientific community about just how serious the problem had become. From the Arctic ice melt, which was happening at a pace that no one expected, to the testimonies of people on the ground whose homes are being destroyed by typhoons and hurricanes, and on and on. So with this news, with this election, it feels like we've crashed into a ditch in many respects. This is much more than hitting a speed bump. And we have always wanted and sought to be very honest, both about the scale of the problem of climate change, but also about the relative scale and power of our movement. And it's clear in this moment, we are not strong enough. And so we have to do something serious about that. And we have to try things we haven't tried before. We have to do organizing in ways we haven't tried it.
What do you mean when you say new organizing techniques?
There's obviously incredible innovation happening in digital organizing and being able to organize protests very quickly by putting a Facebook event out. That's amazing, and that kind of work is going to keep happening. At the same time, there are tried and true methods of going to meet people at their doorsteps and having conversations that could actually change people's minds. And I think at a moment like this, where the polarization in the country is so extreme, we've got to be looking at some of those traditional tactics and perhaps trying them at new scales or in new ways.
With likely little or no support in the Trump administration for federal climate policies like the Clean Power Plan, how much influence can state and local government and communities have on meaningful climate action?
It's a great point and something that a lot of movements are thinking about right now. We're not just going to fight harder as if nothing has changed. We're going to be building our power on the local and state level through local elections, through city and state organizing, and through smart local policies to protect the most vulnerable people, to keep fossil fuels in the ground, reduce emissions, and fight for a new economy that works for people and the planet.
Do you think that there's enough power on those levels to kind of counteract the policies that may or may not be in place under a Trump administration?
We don't know yet. And I think right now the answer is probably no, but we can build it. And this is power we know how to build. This is how movements have fought back against threats over many years. It's something we're quite familiar with in the climate movement and at 350. We worked on the fossil fuel divestment campaign for many years, which gave students, union members, church attendees a tool with which to organize and learn how to hold meetings, create goals, ask decision makers to make change. All of these kinds of tools help build leaders. And so there are many, many leaders currently active, but we know we're going to need more if we're going to counteract an agenda as fierce and dangerous as the one that's being suggested in the agenda.
What have your members been saying to you? What have you been hearing from them about the election outcome and their hopes for the future?
Well, first of all, we're hearing a lot from people, and that's been encouraging in and of itself. And we're hearing from people who have not been active before. We're getting new signups. We're starting to get a lot of ideas from people, getting emails suggesting, you know, what if we tried this thing on Inauguration Day? What if everybody at the local level focused on this one project? So I'm taking heart from that. We're also hearing that people are very sobered, and I am experiencing a new seriousness, taking off the rose-colored glasses and really trying to focus on what's going to be most important and most effective and not wanting to waste any time.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome.
May Bouvie is executive director at 350.org, and I spoke with her from her office in New York. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Many of us have a fridge loaded up with Thanksgiving leftovers. Potatoes, gravy. I'm full just thinking about it. Well, before the big feast, I visited the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant at her home, in her kitchen. We wanted to look at the environmental aspects of the holiday meal. So as she was prepping some vegetables, we talked about the role genetically modified foods are playing on our plates.
Careful, it's going to be hot. It smells so good in here. She's got bread baking in the oven. Hey, Kara, thanks so much for stopping by.
Well, thanks for having us. Okay, so what do you have going here?
Well, as with any good meal, I'm starting by chopping an onion. I stopped by the farm market to shop, and they were showing this film, GMO OMG. It's about genetically modified organisms in our food. So I decided to talk with a few people. I met Kathleen Chiquin and Tony Gosmer. They're teachers at an inner city school. Here's what they had to say.
We're real concerned about food for a lot of reasons, for ourselves and our students. We work in inner city, and a lot of these kids they're getting
zero nutrition. They're suffering from nutritional deficiencies, but we're trying to raise scores, and they're eating GMO, corn and soy, every other day, and that's what they're eating.
And you feel like that affects their ability to learn?
Oh, yes. Nobody knows what these side effects are going to be. It's long term.
Okay, so there are many people with concerns about GMOs. Since we're here for Thanksgiving, what's GMO on our holiday plate?
Okay, we've got some winter squash here, some delicata, some acorn squash. Those are not GMO. But some of the summer squash, the crookneck, yellow squashes, and zucchinis, some of those are bioengineered, and it makes them resistant to common squash viruses.
What about my favorite Thanksgiving side, the mashed potatoes? What about potatoes?
Well, there aren't GMO potatoes on the market yet. The Food and Drug Administration did approve a GMO potato. It's supposed to be less likely to bruise. And those are supposed to be on the market in 2017. And it's the same thing with GMO apples.
Yeah, you have some apples here on the countertop, and they, I guess, are going to be in a pie later today. What about GMO apples?
The GMO apples that are supposedly coming out are engineered so they don't brown after you cut them.
How does that work?
The way they say they do it is they modify them to remove the enzyme that turns an apple brown after it's been exposed to oxygen in the air.
But how do we know which apples are GMO in the store?
Well, same thing. None of them are GMO yet. The ones that are going to be GMO come 2017 are under the brand name Arctic Apples, and they're making them in the Granny Smith and Golden Delicious varieties.
Okay, you've got your cutting board out here, and oh, you're cutting corn right off the cob. What are we making with that?
Well, this is going to be a corn soup to start off the meal. Now, corn, this is a big player in the GMO world. 90% of corn grown in the U.S. is what's called Roundup Ready.
That's when they modify it to make it resistant to the herbicide Roundup.
Exactly. And more specifically than Roundup is glyphosate. That's the chemical that's in Roundup and is now found in other name brands as well. And farmers can spray this herbicide all over the fields. The idea is that it kills the weeds, but the crops survive.
So this corn, the sweet corn that you're cutting right now, is it GMO?
It's hard to tell. Most sweet corn that you buy is actually not GMO. It's the field corn that's the real GMO player. That's what's fed to animals. It's mixed in with GMO soybeans and other grains. It also winds up in our processed food. So anything with corn syrup or soy protein isolate, things like that, that's GMO.
We're having Thanksgiving here in the U.S., but haven't European countries been banning GMOs?
Yeah, many have. I spoke with Mark Linus about this. He used to be an anti-GMO activist in England. He then very publicly came out and said he supports genetically engineered foods. He's now political director for the Cornell Alliance for Science. That's at Cornell University. And he does not like this move in Europe toward banning GMOs.
And there are certain countries which are just against the use of the technology, really per se. Germany is one of them, France is another, Italy is another. So some of the big countries in Central Europe really don't allow an informed scientific debate on the GMO issue at all.
And Linus says that's bad for places that could really use GMOs, places like in sub-Saharan Africa. He says the European bans scare them off of genetically engineered crops, but he says GMO foods could really help to feed people.
Remember, there's a big difference between the situation in somewhere like Uganda and somewhere like France. In France, people have sufficient food, and they can make a choice to buy organic, and they can make a choice to buy non-GMO, and it doesn't make any difference to their food security. That's not really the case in East Africa, where there's several emerging new diseases which really only have solutions using GM technology.
So Linus has changed his tune on GMOs, but there are lots of other people who are still concerned.
Yes. So to hear more about that, I got in touch with the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture. Franklin Egan is PASA's director of education. He says for the past 20 years, GMOs haven't really been used to feed people.
Almost all the attention has been on commodity crops, on corn and soybeans and other row crops, and not on improving food crops, you know, vegetables and fruits that actually provide sustenance to people.
Most of those commodity crops in the U.S. use that Roundup Ready system.
Well, thanks, Julie.
It's so fun to have you here, Kara.
It's great to be here. And now let's just set this GMO stuff to the side for a moment and enjoy everything that you've made for us. Can you pass the bread, please?
That was the Allegheny Friends Julie Grant from her kitchen. And by the way, that corn soup was amazing. U.S. consumers will soon have an easier time figuring out which of their favorite foods is made with GMOs. Congress passed and President Obama signed a bill requiring companies to label foods made with genetically modified ingredients. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is still working out the details. I'm Carol Holsapple, and this is the Allegheny Front.
Thank you.
Are you still working on that Thanksgiving bird? As you're making that second or third turkey sandwich, have a listen to hobby farmer Ken Kiakia's take on his gang. That's a group of domesticated turkeys. He says not all turkeys are created equal. There's a difference between a locally sourced turkey and one from a large commercial operation. His proof? One particularly big bird.
I sing you the song of Turkmenistan, a 43-pound monster of a tom turkey we raised on our little farm. Stan actually wasn't the only scale buster we've raised. For a number of years, the processor we take them to has commented on how large our birds are. Our secret isn't actually a secret. We pasture them. Now, many of you will know what that means, but the government and large producers have conspired, intentionally or not, to make the terminology confusing. So let me get to that first. The byword in alternative food sourcing used to be free range. When you used that term, many people pictured what we do with our birds. In the morning, I feed them some grain and open a pop door so that they can go outside and roam our 26 acres. In the evening, my wife Heather closes the door behind them. Come sundown, they've filed back into the coop on their own, ready for bedtime. The USDA, though, gives an amazingly short definition of free range. Quote, producers must demonstrate to the agency that the poultry has been allowed access to the outside. That's it. It doesn't specify how long or what surface the bird has access to. A few minutes on gravel will satisfy the requirement. So we small-scale farmers fell back on pastured to convey that the birds actually have meaningful access to grass, bugs, and a generally natural environment. Chickens and turkeys are both omnivores and enthusiastically hunt and forage all day when given the opportunity. In our case, in addition to mowed grass, our birds forage in the pastures where we keep our goats and sheep, as well as scrub brush and even some woods. Adolescent turkeys are like little predatory dinosaurs, and they're prodigious foragers. Heather noted early on that when we gave them the ability to hunt out their own food, we didn't need to feed them as much grain. They actually prefer the wild stuff. People have this idea that turkeys are stupid, but they're only non-precocial. They aren't born with as many innate behaviors as chickens. Given a more natural environment, they're inquisitive and enterprising. In any case, pasturing has been good to our turkeys, and we believe it's good for us too. You see all sorts of claims about the health benefits and taste improvements from pastured and other locally sourced meats. But for us, it's as much about the animal's quality of life. Turkmenistan got so large because he got to live like a real turkey, and that meant having some freedom to feed himself. We couldn't even sell him because people wouldn't believe he'd fit in the oven. But he did, and he was delicious.
That was commentator Ken Kiakia. Now, I like Thanksgiving pumpkin pie as much as the next person, but I subscribe to the theory that if it's not chocolate, it's not really dessert. Journalist and author Simran Sethi is right there with me. She chose chocolate and other favorites like wine and coffee to tell a story about the loss of biodiversity in all of the foods we enjoy. Her book, Bread, Wine, Chocolate, is filled with descriptions of savoring the experience of food, but also points to some important numbers, like this. 95% of the world's calories come from just 30 species. We're basically eating all the same things. I spoke with Sethi from a studio in North Carolina and asked, why is this a problem?
If you think about it the way we think about something like an investment portfolio, if we're, you know, advised by someone on how to invest what little money we may have in savings, what they all say is don't put everything in one basket. What we know when we do that, if we say put everything in one stock, let's say, and that stock crashed, you would lose everything. So the exact same thing is happening to food, but it's this greatest, you know, most important story about food and agriculture that isn't really being told. You know, our diet has now collapsed globally into really wheat, rice, corn, soybeans, and palm oil. And we're growing the same types of foods and we're growing the same varieties. And they tend to be the ones that are high yielding and that are disease resistant to whatever capacity they can be. But the problem with doing this is if one of them succumbs to a disease, if one of them succumbs to a pest, then what happens? If we haven't been growing diverse varieties of not only those five foods, but all the foods that we love, then we'll lose them.
I love the scene in the book where you're on the cacao farm. And that's the plant that chocolate comes from. I think it's in Ecuador. And you say of that experience, these were the tastes of biodiversity. Could you describe that scene a little bit and what you meant by that?
I've been eating chocolate my entire life, so it's something I love deeply. But I had never considered where it came from. And then there I was in the center of origin for cacao. So cacao, as you said, becomes chocolate. And I entered into a forest, a very dense forest, and there are these trees and they have these things hanging off of them that look like kind of ridged footballs. And they're absolutely bizarre because they're very, very heavy. And they're on these kind of tiny stems on thick trunks. And you're like, where am I? Like, what is this weird thing hanging off this tree? And you split it open and there's this pulpy white fruits inside. And inside of those fruits are the seeds that will one day become chocolate. And the tastes of biodiversity are right there. And what I mean by that is that within every single one of those cacao pods, those little fruits that come in colors ranging from purple to green to yellow to red, there are myriad tastes of what the fruit tastes like. And when I dug my hands, my very sticky, dirty, insect-repellent, sticky hands into those fruits, which are kind of very moist, very warm, you know, because I'm in a tropical forest, and I dug out these fruits and I popped them in my mouth. My eyes were popping out of my head. I'm not kidding. I was tasting something that tasted a lot like sweet tarts. I was tasting, you know, something lemony. I was tasting something a little bit more approximating a nut, you know, and it was like, what is happening here? All these flavors are in this one pod of cacao. And then you start to think about this and you're like, wow, once these seeds are roasted and turned into something, they have a special taste. And every single region in the world that grows cacao is known for a particular kind of taste, but it's starts right there.
You know, we're talking about wine and chocolate, kind of luxury items. We don't really need them, maybe with the exception of bread. But you point out that these foods are not luxury items for the people who produce them. They're their livelihoods. How does more biodiversity in the foods we eat benefit growers and producers?
This is the part of the story that is most compelling to me. We're not only growing fewer varieties of, let's say, apples, but we're growing fewer apples in general, right? I mean, just to use apples as an example, we just eat fewer types of foods. And then within that, within whatever it is we're eating even less kind of diverse varieties. So that's genetic erosion. And that translates down into the loss of biodiversity in our soil, the loss of diversity in the kinds of seeds that we're sowing. For me, as I was hearing about this, what I also realized was through industrialized agriculture, we're losing something that I consider even more precious, what I refer to as cultural erosion. And that is the knowledge that farmers already have. That indigenous wisdom, that traditional knowing, those seeds are what disappear when we start to sow fields full of genetically engineered corn. It becomes a kind of cookie cutter process. And that to me strips away the art of what this is. Somebody is growing our food. Those hands are making what will go into our bodies and nourish us. And those hands are incredibly important to me.
Simran Sethi is the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate: The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. If you like chocolate as much as I do, check out our website. There's an excerpt from the chocolate chapter there. That's AlleghenyFront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsoppel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mavis McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation.